And good Monday morning. I'm Beth Pike, and welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. On today's edition, our host, David Bell, returns with his guest, Andre Carson, and they're going to be discussing how race and economics guide adolescents toward the criminal justice system and how laws are keeping them there as adults. We're also going to be opening up the phone lines during the show, and you'll want to stay tuned because at the middle of the show, we always have our calendar of events, and then towards the end, you'll find we have the 420 drug war news. But now, coming up, it's David and his guest, Andre. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning.
This is David Bell, Jaws of Justice. I'm here with Andre Carson. Our last episode, we were talking about influences on individuals, different variables, if you will, that help guide people into the criminal justice system and then help keep them there. During the show last few weeks ago, we were talking to Andre Carson, and we had a lot of feedback from the show, and they wanted to hear not so much how people got into the system, although we'll touch on that some more. They wanted to hear how Andre got out, and so we're calling this the show Redemption of Andre Carson. And so I want to jump into where we were before, and let's just get right into it, Andre. In the second half of the show, we will be taking calls at 816-931-5534. That'll be the second half of the show. Andre, let me take you back to last week's show. You have you dropped out of high school. You've started running the streets a little bit. You're looking up to your older brother. You've committed a few robberies, and now you find yourself at a young age, you're in Jackson County Detention Center on the third floor, and that's where they originally put kind of the younger guys. You're in there. You can't hear yourself think. You can't hear yourself on the phone. It just sounds almost just an out-of-control place. You're causing some trouble there, but they can't pin it on you. And so they just move you. And what they do is they move you to the fourth floor. And you get up to the fourth floor, and all of a sudden everything's just kind of settled down. It's kind of quiet. People are at the different tables in kind of, I'll call the day area, which is right outside all the cells, and they're playing chess or doing whatever they're doing, and they're quiet, but you're still wanting to stir up trouble, but you're not getting a reaction out of anybody. And that's that first day. So that night, as you're preparing to go to bed in that day area because it's overcrowded, there's not enough cells, you think that they're going to come get you, that they're planning because no one's talking to you, that they're going to come get you that night. And as you're sitting there on the floor, with some blanket, presumably, you decide to put your shoes on because you want to be ready when someone jumps you. Is that right?
Well, I never took my shoes off.
You never took your shoes off. Okay. Right. So you're sitting there, your shoes on. You're waiting for something to happen that night. The lights go out. Take us from there.
Well, as you stated earlier, after I came in and it caused a confusion, at least what I thought I was causing, it didn't happen. So that night, as hard as I thought I was being, I was still a little paranoid from the fact that I wasn't getting any kind of response from the individuals that was in this particular tank. At this time, the jail population had got a little overcrowded, so they opened up what was adjacent to that particular tank. It was a bigger day room, which they would fit 10 more, wouldn't even call them bunks, just bed pads, to where you sleep on the floor. So in addition to the 16 holding cells that's in the regular tank, there was the 10 beds on the floor, so that made 26 individuals in there. And on the floor is where everybody went to who just came into the cell, I mean into the tank. Again, because I didn't get a response, you know, it made me feel like I was being plotted against. So I just sat on my mattress, and you know, with my knees up, and my arms laying on my knees, just waiting for somebody to try something, because I was telling myself that, you know, I was going, you know, all the things I was going to do. But that night, as I was sitting there just waiting, I would hear different conversations throughout the pod, even in the cells and from guys that was laying, you know, inches away from me, talking about the life that they left behind, the choices that they made to get them where they were, and the chances that they had before this time to actually make something of themselves or to stay out of prison, and how they just blew it away. I heard guys talking about they were going to be there and they weren't going to be able to witness their children graduating high school because they had so much time. And these kids were small children under 10 years old. So, and the fact that they were going to miss these graduations meant that they was going to spend a significant amount of time still incarcerated. I mean, and just hearing these types of conversations and the heartfelt that was put into them, you can understand the pain that a lot of these guys were going through, even though for the majority of the individuals, you could say that they brought that situation on themselves, but you can deny the pain that the individuals are going through. And that right there in itself touched something in me that made me feel like I didn't want this. I didn't know what I wanted out of life, but I knew I didn't want that.
But when we talked last time, I got the impression from some of the guys you're running with earlier on, and by the way, how old were you when that conversation that you kind of witnessed? How old were you at that time? About like 18 or 19?
No, yeah, I believe I was still 17.
17. So I got, and by the way, that's the official adult age in the state of Missouri generally for criminal laws to apply. But I got the impression that before that, the guys you're running with, that kind of openness, that kind of showing this regret, showing this kind of inner feeling was almost, I wouldn't say forbidden, but it was almost like a suggestion that you were weak if you opened up like that. Is that right? Or
that's definitely correct. I mean, as I went along, I realized that there were a lot of things that I wanted to do with my life and I wanted to talk about when I was growing up as a teenager, but there was really nobody to talk about those ideas with, because you just didn't you didn't have conversations that made you assume to be weak, to have feelings.
So having feelings was equated, at least when you're growing up, to being weak. At least, does that
correct
sound right?
Yes.
Okay, so you hear this from some of these older guys, and by the way, these guys, when we said older, they're really, as you look back now, they're not really older at all, are they?
Well, some of them weren't, but at 17, the youngest guy that was in that tank was 27 years old.
Okay.
So just looking back now, that doesn't seem right that much older. But for a 17-year-old to have a 10-year age difference for the youngest individual that was there, I mean, that was a pretty big gap.
So did you eventually fall asleep that night after you realized that you're not going to get jumped?
Yeah, I probably got about an hour of sleep that night, but my thoughts went from being paranoid about these individuals to paranoid about my future. So it took a significant change.
So you wake up the next morning, and are you still trying to cause trouble, get reaction out of people, or what do you do the next morning?
No, my whole paradigm changed. I wasn't so much trying to elicit some type of response from these individuals, but just from hearing the conversations that I heard that night, I just figured it was best just to keep my mouth shut and just keep listening.
And that's what you did?
Yeah.
And you were there for 2 years approximately before you went to prison?
That's a little over 2 years, yes.
Okay. During that time period, were there any other – was it just listening? Did anybody take you under the wing? Did you – under their wing? Did you talk to anybody? Were you able to open up yourself during that time period?
During that time, I did realize that it was okay to talk more in depth about – who you were and what you wanted out of life. I mean, the sad thing about it was that a lot of the individuals that I talked to, they really didn't have much of a future outside of being in prison, either because of the fact that they had a significant amount of time to do or because of the fact that their lifestyle made it impossible for them to actually change because they had become so wrapped up in it.
But you had become so wrapped up in it at that point.
Well, I won't say that I become so wrapped up in it because, again, I mean, I was still young. So even though I grew up in it, I had not gotten to that point to where I'd spent a significant portion of my adult life, you know, just thinking criminally. So for me, there was still the possibility of a mindset change, you know, given certain circumstances. You're talking about a lot of individuals here have been doing this, you know, they're 30 years old now, and they've been in and out of prison, so it's become a way of life for them.
So if I would have seen Andre Carson the night you sat on your bunk, holding your knees, waiting for someone to jump you, and then seeing the same Andre Carson, you know, 5 days later in the day room walking around, would I, as an outside observer, been able to notice just a difference in the way you carried yourself and the way you were talking to people, interacting? Was it that drastic of a change?
You would have, if you knew who I was before that, you would have noticed a change not so significant to where you felt like I'd made a change in my mm-hmm. life. But you would know that I was a little bit more calmer, a little bit more selective about what I said. But I still was not the person I am today.
And before we leave the past, when I say the past, from that moment backward, I want to ask one more thing. Mm-hmm. You had positive role models in your life growing up to that point. We've talked about it. You had family members that were positive role models. What was it about that moment that made you receptive to hearing that message? Because it seemed to me you had heard that message before that point, right? You had seen your mother, I think you talked about your stepfather. Mm-hmm. There were positive role models around you, but you didn't hear the message until, you know, sitting in the fourth floor, Jackson County Detention Center at night waiting to get jumped.
Well, growing up, the positive role models that I come from were mainly religious. It was mainly do good because God wants you to. Not that that's a bad thing, but that's not necessarily a teaching point for adolescents to pretty much go on a straight and narrow. That pretty much tries to scare you into doing right, or you know, you will be punished. But it wasn't real. You know, it wasn't something that really made a significant impact. Sitting here and listening to individuals who have actually lost their lives because of significant prison time was real. I mean, and that was something that was a possibility for me at that time because I was facing a lot of time.
So do you wind up pleading guilty?
Yes.
Okay. And you go to prison for how long approximately? Or what's the sentence, I guess?
For Missouri, I had several 10 and 5-year sentences ran together, which the 5 and 10s were run consecutive, which means they were run separately. So I ended up with a 15-year sentence.
Okay. So you go down to – you wind up going to prison in Missouri?
That's correct.
Okay. Is this desire for change? You don't know what you want to do, but you know something's – you want to make that change. Are there is anything else that comes along next that we can look to and say, hey, this is a point in your life you remember? Either you met somebody, or – I know you and I talked about chess as an example. I don't know. Is that the next kind of marker, if you will?
Well, that's definitely one of the markers that for me was significant. Before I left the county jail – at this point in time, I was on the fifth. I'd made it to the fifth floor because I ended up being moved to the fifth floor, probably a few months after I'd made it to the fourth floor. So I was in the fifth. I was on the fifth floor, and there was an individual who was there who had spent several years in prison. He was still considered a young guy. I think he was about 28 years old. But he had spent several years in prison already, and he knew how to play chess. And I used to sit back and watch him and other people play chess, and the game fascinated me, but I just didn't understand the pieces and why they moved the way they did, because they were so different from checkers. And he saw that I watched them, and he asked me if I wanted to learn. So I told him, yeah, you know. And he used to beat me on a regular basis, and I remember his name. It just came to me because of what he used to say. His name was Thrasher, and he used to use that his last name as a verb for what he used to do to people on that chess table, and he did that. But it took several weeks for me to actually get it down to where I could really play the game. And he made the significance when I started learning how to play the game. I went after pieces just to collect. And he used to sit back and smile and tell me, you can have all those.
You can have all the little pawns you want.
Yeah, he told me I could have all. He said, I see you want to collect pieces. You can have all those. And I'm thinking I'm doing good because I have more pieces on my side that I've taken from him than he has on his side. And he said all that doesn't matter. You know, he said you can collect. You can be a collector all you want to, but if you don't have a purpose in what you're doing in the moves that you're making, you're gonna always lose. And it didn't hit me until every time I would collect and he would go straight for my, he'd go straight for my queen and make me. And it, I couldn't figure out why this was happening when I had so many of his pieces. And he told me, one of the things he told me I can remember was that just as in life, you can always plan for just the step ahead and you will lose in the long run. But whenever you plan several steps ahead to figure out what it is you want to do and how you're going to get there, you always become successful in that. And that was one of the things that stood out to me.
And so stepping back, were you looking at, you know, chess as a representative of life, I guess?
Yes.
That what? And were you able to go back and kind of analyze your life based on that chessboard?
Oh, with chess, I equate a lot of things in life to chess. The fact that you have to go into it with a game plan and you can't just think about just collecting things. You can't just think about going in life just to get that quick that quick gratification to know that you've gotten something. You have to go into life with mapping out a plan to figure out where you're trying to get to and what it is you want to have and figure out how to get there, because with each move that you make, there's always that consequence to opening up something in your life to go wrong.
So let's move to the next point. And I know we're going to take calls the second half of the show. Again, the number is 816-931-5534. This is David Bell. We're here with Andre Carson. The next point in your life is what? And I know there's many points, but right, in terms of a brief period of time that we have, what would be the next kind of marker, if you will?
The next marker for me was, I think, when I actually went to prison. I mean, before we go to prison, we were taken to a diagnostic center, which is in Fulton, and I stayed there for a little over a month. But the significant part of that move was when I got actually sent to the prison that I was going to spend the next several years at. When we pulled up into the yard in the bus, we pulled into Mobley, which is where I was at, and they take you to the center of the yard, which is where everybody's at the time. The yard is open, everybody's out, and the bus pulls up right into the center of the yard. So we get out, and you hear all the cat calls, you hear all the threats and baby calls to a lot of us guys, because they knew a lot of us were newcomers. And one of the first things that I noticed when we are all off the bus and lined up in front of the bus is that they were taking an individual to the infirmary on a stretcher, and to come to find out later that the guy got jumped on, he had his head busted, and it was right inside the place that what we call R&O, where all the receiving and orientation, where all the new people would be going to. And it was inmates that was carrying them. It wasn't guards. It was inmates who were taking them there because they had got there first, and they were helping to take them there. But it made me understand that this was a real situation. It was pretty much not a game.
So at that point, I know we go back to this moment again, sitting on the floor of the fourth floor of Jackson County Detention Center, the chest, the advice of this individual thrasher. But now you're in a situation where it's almost like isn't it just fight or flight at that moment? Don't you want to revert back to everything you had learned up to the chess lesson?
I pretty much did. When I seen that, I knew that that civility it wasn't an option at this moment. It was either you step up and so-called be a man or you won't make it out of here.
So, but your personal development doesn't end at that point. It doesn't necessarily go backwards. It actually moves forwards. I know the next point that you and I have talked about was a book that you were made aware of. Is that going along in this
that
timeline?
Yeah, that I made it down to Mobley in 91. I think I got the book to read probably in 94, 95.
Okay. And before we tell you the book, who gave it to you? How does it come up that someone's going to, you know, you're going to get a book and you're going to actually sit down and read it?
Yeah, where eventually I made several acquaintances while I was there, and one of the individuals who I used to play basketball with, his name was Kurt, and he was a short guy, but he played basketball with a lot of tenacity, and he could beat a lot of individuals. But he was somebody who I used to what we call walk the yard with. We walk around the track and we talk about things. And he was about 10 years older than I was at that particular time. And he had already spent several years in prison at that particular time. But he was one of those ones who I would consider an old head. And old head meaning somebody who spent several years in prison already. And he would verse me on several different things and talk about life in general, and he saw that I was receptive to his conversation, and he had had a book that he was reading, and he said that it enlightened him on a lot of things about himself, and he wanted me to read it. And at that time I was thinking, you know, I'm not sure if I want to read it simply because he thinks it's good, but he was pretty adamant about it. He's like, I think you'll like this book. You know, check it out.
Now, before that, had you been reading other books at all?
Or? Yeah, at this point, when you're incarcerated, you probably read more than you ever thought you would. Yeah.
Okay. And so at this point, he says, here's this book. And what is that book?
That book was a book called Makes Me Want to Holler by Nathan McCall.
All right. And when you and I were talking before we did the first show, I asked you, I said, is there a book that I can read that would kind of help me understand what you've been through?
Right.
And without missing a beat, that was the book. And I will tell you, this is to our listeners, I went out and got the book immediately, read it, and it's an incredible book. And I highly recommend it to everybody. If you want to learn more about kind of these experiences and kind of this, we called it the redemption of Andre Carson, but just kind of this, there's a lot of similarities, it seems to me. Even the chess that we talk about,
yes,
that you talked about here, that was prominent in the book.
Yes, it was. I mean, the book was so eerily similar to what I was going through and what I'd been through, and not only myself, but to a lot of other individuals as well. I mean, the book is it was in a different time than the time that I'd spent doing the things that I did, but it was still very similar to what I was going through, and I could relate to it.
And so when do you eventually transfer over to Kansas prison as well, or is that, or what's the next step?
The next step from there was, I mean, I eventually ended up filing in the Kansas courts to get my cases taken care of in Kansas. And
because you've been charged in a series of events in Kansas and Missouri.
Correct.
So you filed for kind of I forgot the actual term at this point, but you filed to take care of your Kansas cases while you're incarcerated in Missouri.
Right.
They take you over to Kansas. Do you wind up spending time in Kansas?
Yes. I after spending 7 years in Missouri, I ended up going to Kansas to spend another 7 years.
Okay. And, again, do you dispose of your cases in Kansas by a guilty plea as well?
Yes.
Okay. You could have chosen to fight it had you wanted to, but was it a decision on your point, regardless of the facts, but to you want to move forward, you want to get to this new place, whatever it is, in terms of your own personal development?
Yes. I mean, I wanted to – I knew that they had enough evidence against me to convict me, and again at that particular time I wanted to try and get as less as possible in order for me to actually have a life afterwards.
And at that moment, had you, and again we're going to go to the call-in show in a little bit after a station break, and so I think I want to ask Andre back for a third show, but had you at that point, had you started to formulate in your mind what future was for you?
I started to formulate a little bit about the fact that, especially after reading this book, that if it was possible for him to do what he did as far as going through the system like he did and eventually taking control of his own life, then that was possible for me, which gave me the motto that I had, which was, if you can do it, then so can I.
And so how much longer? You were going to spend 7 more years in the Kansas Department of Corrections.
That's correct.
And so what year would you eventually get out?
2002, okay. Christmas Eve.
All right. You're listening to Jaws of Justice. This is David Bell. We're talking to Andre Carson. Real briefly, again, the book, we're going to go to a call-in show here shortly, but briefly, the name of the book, again, is Makes Me
Want to Holler by Nathan McCall.
By Nathan McCall. And he actually wrote a second book, which I also bought after I finished the first one, which is a series of essays, which was also I think, very insightful. But that first book, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a chance, you're interested in the topic, because you must be, you're listening now, I highly recommend you get the book. So after the break, we will start taking calls at 816-931-5534. This is Jaws of Justice.
This is the Jaws of Justice calendar of events for August 17th, 2015. Give Yourself Real Love, and the Black Healthcare Coalition is sponsoring a Mind, Body, Soul Expo for women, Saturday, August 29th, from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Mary Kelly Center, 2803 East 51st Street, Kansas City, Missouri. The expo will feature women's health services, clinical breast exams, blood pressure and glucose testing, body mass index testing, and more. To find out more, contact GIRL, that's G-Y-R-L, at 816-651-0044, or email to GIRL, that's capital G period, capital Y period, capital R period, capital L period, followed by V-O-T-P in the lowercase at gmail.com. Diamond Cuts is sponsoring a back-to-school bash Sunday, August 23rd, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at 3402 Truce, Kansas City, Missouri. Food and drink will be provided, as well as haircuts and school supplies. There will also be activities and exhibits ranging from horses to moonwalks, a car show, drill teams, and more. The public is invited. There will be a Community Unity, Justice, and Peace Rally Saturday, August 29th from 5 to 8 p.m. at the Freedom Fountain, 4700 Cleveland, Kansas City, Missouri. Guest speakers will be Representative Brandon Ellington, Saja Kaya, and Maurice Copeland. There will be information available about bus transportation to the 20th anniversary of the Million Man March celebration, or check out www.justiceorelse.com. And for more information or other activities around Kansas City, go to www.kcloc.com. My name is Keith Brownell, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org.
And you're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. I'm Beth Pike, and I invite you to listen in next week to Jaws of Justice Radio when Jessica Thomas has Thomas Mundell on. And they're going to talk about his meeting with politicians from the state all the way up to the president about medical marijuana and the update on legalization efforts in Missouri. But now we're going to return you back to David Bell and his guest Andre Carson, and they will be taking your phone calls at 816-931-5534.
Hi, this is David Bell, and you're listening to Jaws of Justice. I'm here with Andre Carson. We left off, Andre, I think you had an idea of the future, or at least you knew you wanted to be there for the future, I think. How does that?
Yes, does that sounds correct.
But I think you had some obstacles you had to overcome, and I'm going to talk in general about the prison experience. The first is education. I know in our first show, we were interviewing you a few weeks ago, you had dropped out of high school, and it was, you know, just a gradual kind of missing classes, missing more, getting suspended, and just kind of, you know, one day you just don't go after a long process of it. You've been out of the educational system for a while. Do you decide to try to make that right? And I guess if you do, why?
Well, yes, I do try to make that right. For me, for one, I wanted to do it for my mother because as well as for myself, but I wanted to do it for my mother because I knew that she had so much hope for me that I let her down, and I wanted to give something back to her. But also I knew that education was important to any type of success that I was ever going to have in life. I didn't know what it was that I wanted to do, but I knew that education was going to be a starting point for that. So I went back. Once I did make it to Mobley, one of the first things that I did was signed up for GED classes. And
let me stop you there for a second. You sign up for GED. First of all, how do you physically sign up? I mean, is there a board on the window, the paper you sign up, or do you fill out a request? And then how long does it take? And
there's a request forms that you fill out for, and for anything, for any activity at the institution that you're in, and then they put you on a call-in list for it. And once you're on a call-in list for it, then you're able to move to those particular places.
And so how long does it take you to study to get your GED?
Well, for me, they immediately put me on the list. I think they immediately put everybody on the list who signs up for GED, and it took me probably 2 months to get the GED.
At 2 months of studying to actually pass the test?
Yes.
Okay. Do you remember, how do you get the results back?
The teacher ends up the instructor brings in the results for everything. There's an instructor we go to the activity building to actually do the GED testing. And once the results are back, they bring you the.
And do you remember when you heard that you passed?
Yes.
And tell us about that briefly.
It made me feel like a sense of accomplishment. I mean, I've not accomplished so much up to that point to been able to get that GED and pass it at such a quick rate. It made me feel a little empowered to feel like I can, you know, I had some control over what I could do.
Was this the first affirmation that you had, at least with regard to education and your kind of intellectual abilities?
Oh, exactly. Well, no, not really, because growing up until my high school years, I was actually an A and B student.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So this is David Bell. I'm here with Andre Carson. We're taking calls, 816-931-5534, 816-931-5534. Now, you eventually start taking college classes in there as well. Is that right?
Once I made it to in Missouri, I was able to take some college courses because they had the Pell Grant.
Mm-hmm.
And inmates was able to get those Pell Grants to go to college, and they were eventually cut off. But yes, I was able to take about a year's worth of college classes.
All right, we have a caller on the line. Caller, state your name and where you're from.
Yes, my name is Robert, and I'm calling from Midtown, Kansas City.
All right, Robert, what's your comment?
Yes, first of all, I just wanted to commend you guys for the show that you're doing today and your guests. I'm working, and I'm hearing parts and bits of it, but I've liked what I've heard so far, because I wanted to call and say I'm a former convicted felon inmate, and I served 13 years and 1 month in the federal system. And I was listening to this brother's all the advice that he was given, which is positive, and just to commend him, because we need more brothers like that who's been inside, seen what it's like to come out and give back to the community. I've been back out on the streets for 10.5 years successfully, great job and marriage and home, the so-called American dream, you know, and I also stop and try to let young people know, you know, that's not the life. And, you know, it may be glorified in music, on television, but that's not the life. It's more positive things that we can do out here on the outside. And just this morning, I stopped, saw a young lady sitting in the park. It was a convict herself, and I shared my story with her. And she's in trouble right now, but she got to see her PO for some things she haven't been doing right. And I told her, just stop, take a deep breath, go see your PO. Get your life together, and just it's better out here doing the things like your guests is doing, and I've been successful at it. So I just want to commend them and commend you guys for even having this show that others may hear that may be going through the same thing that made your guests.
Well, thank you, and congratulations to you, and thank you for your comment. You know, Andre, one of the things that I hear with this caller, and I've heard in your voice and your story when we talked off the air and on the air, in my own personal experience in the criminal justice system as a criminal defense attorney, there seems to be the dividing line seems to be between hope and no hope, and it seems to me that when there's a sense of hope there, that at least that has to be there, and that's the kind of the initial something, and everything follows from that. Does that ring true with you, or how does that?
Yes, I've been asked that question several times in different ways. As far as how do you help somebody change their lifestyle and to start thinking more positive about themselves? A lot of times, people who were in my situation to begin with, and who are still in that type of situation, hope plays a big part. If an individual doesn't feel as if their life has any significant meaning, or their future doesn't have any significant meaning, then there's really not much to strive for. And when I say that, a lot of times we have, coming from that inner city, you have what you would consider limited choices. And the choice pretty much isn't for you to go on and become something later in life, as far as become a doctor or a lawyer. Those are pretty much dreams. Those aren't actual choices that we believe was possible. So things are limited. The choices that you feel like you have to become is to pretty much get paid. And to get paid, you have to be a hustler. You have to sell drugs. You have to rob people. You have to do a lot of different things. And so those are the choices that individuals have to look forward to.
And again, this is a call-in show. If you want to speak to Andre or have a comment, it's 816-931-5534, 816-931-5534. And talking about these limited choices and the hustling and whatever, it seems to me that's the collecting the pieces mentality, if you will, from what we were talking about with chess.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, it's one of those things to where you get as much as you can in the quickest amount of time as you can, so you can enjoy it right then.
Because you don't know where you're going to be tomorrow. You don't know you're going to be alive or wherever, so let's just enjoy it right now.
Right. I mean, and growing up as a teenager, before I went to prison, it was almost a given that I was going to prison. I mean, that was one of the things that I pretty much looked forward to, because, I mean, it was like, well, eventually at some point, I'll be going to prison. Like,
just a rite of passage?
Yeah, like so many people before me. I mean, like my brother's friends. I mean, it was one of those things. You go to prison, you get out, and you have this regard in the neighborhood about somebody who's been to prison and who's got out, and your name becomes a little bit more pronounced in the neighborhood. So it was like, you know, eventually it's going to be my turn to be able to do that, go to prison, get out, and come back and be, you know, glorified by the people that I was with.
And I think we talked about education. You first had to kind of overcome that hurdle, if you will, to kind of get back into it. The other hurdle I know you've talked to me about is you were in a gang when you were out, I guess, before you went in.
This was when I went in.
Oh, you went in.
I had a little clique that I ran with when I was on the street. But once I got in, I got involved with a gang.
Okay, and what gang was that?
It was the GD's Gangster Disciples.
Okay, but that seems like, is that taking a step backwards or not, or how do you?
I guess it's all on how you perceive it. For me, it was taking a step forward because I was becoming a part of something that was much bigger than myself. And if at that particular time, I had it was individuals who was a part of the gang who I knew who wanted me to be a part of what they was doing because they were making money while they were in prison. And also, it was a sense of security knowing that you had a bunch of people who had your back whenever anything went down.
And so, is it accurate to say that you pretty much have to, and I forgot the term that you used, but you have to get together, or you have to get together with the gang if you want to make sure that someone's watching your back and that you're taken care of? Is that right? Or
No, you don't have to. But at that particular time, it felt like a good move for me because I knew people who were in it, and I was always with these individuals, and they were always collectively together as a group, as a gang. So it just seemed like a natural progression for me.
But then I hear you say that, but then how do I square that? I guess in my mind, and this could be my own kind of naivete, is that when you talk about this gang, Gangster Disciples, they're trying to make money in prison, which I understand, but it would seem the same type of mentality you're dealing with on the street would have followed through into this gang. So you're fighting, on the one hand, GED, college, you want to move in this direction, but on the other hand, there's still the same kind of mentality trying to pull you back. But maybe I'm wrong about that.
You're right in the sense that, for me, I knew I wanted something. I wanted something more in life, but because I didn't understand what it was that I wanted, it still made me susceptible to just going with the flow and being a part of what I thought was significant for me at that particular time, which meant that, you know, I wanted to be a part of something bigger than who I was. I wanted to have some type of security while I was in prison, because first and foremost, day-to-day life was more important than the future was. You had to be able to survive on a daily basis before you can actually make it to the future. So that was paramount That was the bigger issue at that particular time. I didn't know how to equate that whole chess thing into making those plans for the future to put things in place to start moving forward as at that point.
Okay. So when were you in Gangsters? When did you join the group?
I joined the group. I'd made it there in like the summer of 91. And because I was hanging with individuals I was hanging with so roughly, I think later that year I ended up
getting
into it.
Okay. And you had already had your – no, then you wound up getting your
– I got my GED before. I got before the summer was done.
Okay. Okay. And we're – again, this is a call-in show, 816-931-5534, 816-931-5534. So you get your GED, you then get in the gang, mm-hmm. and then at some point do you leave the gang?
Yeah, at some point I do leave the gang, which was one of the significant turning points in my life. The scenario on how that happened was a few years later, not too long before I actually left to go to Kansas, there was what we call passing law on somebody. Whenever somebody steps out of line and they have to be dealt with as far as physically.
Is this someone within your own gang
this
that has to be dealt with?
In the own gang. And at this particular point, I was considered a sergeant in the gang. And so it was my sergeant at arms. It was my duty to designate individuals to pass this law that was called down on someone. And this individual had screwed up, had messed up on some money that was for the gang itself, and they had to be dealt with. So I'd got a couple of individuals who I needed to go ahead and make this happen, and we got the guy inside of a utility closet and pretty much passed law on him. But we had hurt him so bad that he had to go to the infirmary, and we all ended up going to the hole behind it, which was almost like a normal occurrence. But after this time of going to the hole, just looking in the mirror, which is just a really polished sheet of metal for a mirror, I'm thinking to myself, I find myself coming to the hole on a regular basis, and it seems like I'm, as much as I want to move forward, I keep going backwards. And you always have that those religious moments when you're incarcerated. So, you know, and I consider myself to be praying, and I said, God, if you make a way for me to get past this, I'll take that chance. I'll take that opportunity.
And so, did that what came about?
Well, to give you an idea, there were Gangster Disciples and Crips were together. Bloods and Vice Lords were together, and these gangs were prominent on the yard. Flags, everybody wore their flags, wore their colors. And the GDs and Crips probably numbered over 200 individuals, and Vice Lords were a little significantly less, but still enough, still a significant force out there. But I'd spent a little over a month in the hole behind this, and when I got out, people were coming up to me telling me about a lot of stuff that had happened during the time that I was in the hole. And what had happened was a lot of people had been moved to – a lot of gang members had been moved to different facilities, had gotten paroled or went to honor centers or, you know, just simply got moved off the yard. So the gang activity had been reduced significantly. I'd say about 70-80% of the gang members had been dispersed to other places. And as I was walking, I was listening to this. I was hearing this voice in the back of my mind. It was telling me, "Well, I've made a hole for you when you walk through it, you know." Mm-hmm. And so at that particular moment, I told the individuals, I said, "I'm done. You know, I'm not being involved anymore. I've made up my mind to do something else, and this just isn't it."
But at that moment, surely that. Isn't there a consequence for that?
There is a consequence for it. I mean, I understood that there was, you know, possibility for a law to be called down on me for leaving the situation, and the threats was made. I mean, they told me they were telling me that you can't just up and leave us. You know, this right here is for life, and you knew that going in, and especially now that everybody's gone, you can't, you know, it's time for you to step up and take leadership of certain aspects. And I told him that, you know, I told him, you know me, if you feel like you need to do something to me, then you know who I am. You know what I'm capable of. I hope it don't come to that, but you know me. So I'm telling you now that this is not what I want. And so what I consider myself was staying true to what I believe God was doing for me at that particular time, was making a door for me to walk through to do something else in life.
And is this at Moberly?
This was still at Moberly.
So at the time you told him I'm done, until the time you transferred out of that facility, how long was it?
I'd say it was probably about 6 months.
So that night, are you in the same position, if you will, your shoes still on in your cell that you were that first night on the fourth floor, right? So at one point, you're waiting for everyone to jump you at Jackson County because you're thinking that something's up. And at this point, now you know something may be up. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that.
Well, it was at that particular moment, I mean, I think I was probably more nervous than I've ever been in my life, because I knew the individuals that I knew and that I ran with in prison, I knew what they were capable of, but they also knew what I was capable of. So, I mean, I had that going for me. But with this, with the whole thing, I mean, I sat and watched. And when I say I sat, I mean, just day to day, I watched these individuals. But because I had been there long enough to gain respect from other individuals, I'd had several other old heads, what we consider, you know, that I'd talked to and was taking me under their wing, was pretty much let me know that if something did go down, they would have my back in the whole process. And there was several individuals speaking on behalf of me to them to just let it go and don't try anything, because they were going to support me in the situation.
And again, this is David Bell. We're here with Andre Carson. We have a caller on the line. Caller, go ahead and state your name and where you're calling from.
This is Keith Brown Eel. I'm calling from the city of Jackson County, Missouri.
Hi, Mr. Keith, go ahead and what's your comment? Hello? We're having some feedback.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Well, we're. I think, Keith, if you want to call back, I think we're having some connection difficulties here. Keith, call back, and we'll take – if we can tell our – program director, we want to take that next call when Keith comes in. It almost sounds to me like you got out of one gang and you got into a different one, but this different one were a group of individuals that were there to look out for you and that kind of saw in you what you were starting to see in yourself was some type of potential for something good?
Yes. There was a I mean, it's hard to forget the people that made significant moments happen in your life, when, especially going through that particular situation. There was another guy who was named, his name was Douglas Burks. He was somebody who mentored me a lot when I was incarcerated. We worked at the same place, at Metal Shop, and we played chess on a regular basis. But he had someone who had spent up to that point, I think it was like 14, 15 years incarcerated, and he still had several years to go before he was going to actually be able to see the streets. But he was somebody who talked positively with me, and he would encourage me on a lot of different things. I mean, he was one of the first people that I told that growing up I wanted to actually go to the military and fly planes. I mean, that was something that I always held in. I never spoke to anybody about. But he was one of those ones that told me that wasn't going to be possible from here on out. But the thing about it is that the possibilities for me to do a lot of the things that I wanted to do once I was released was still available. So he was one of the ones who encouraged me to believe in what it is I wanted to believe in and go after it.
And why was that something that you had held in, by the way?
Again, for one thing, there was nobody to talk about something like that with, because if you told somebody that was something that you wanted to do, first of all, people would criticize you for even wanting to be a part of the military, because that was going to fight for the white man. So, mm-hmm. you, I mean, why would you go fight for somebody who wasn't going to let you do anything? So that would be criticized off top. And then another thing, simply wanting to do something outside of being involved with the neighborhood, it was just silly.
And so you learn at that moment that you disclose this to this gentleman. Is this in the last 6 months at Moberly, by the way, you disclosed this?
It was within the last year.
And so you disclose this. You finally get up enough courage, if you will, to say, hey, this is something I want to do, and I'm still nervous about saying it, but I'm going to say it. And it wasn't until that moment you would learn that the decisions you had made earlier would ultimately prevent you from doing that particular act, meaning of going to the military to fly planes.
Well, I mean, I knew that I wouldn't be able to do that before.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, okay. I knew that I wouldn't be, because when I first got incarcerated, I spoke to the public defender that I had to see if I can get released to the military instead of going to prison, but because of the serious nature of my crime, that simply wasn't possible.
We have two callers on the line. First caller, what's your name and where are you calling from?
This is Keith Brown. You know, I'm calling from Jackson County, Kansas City, Missouri.
All right, go ahead. Keith, what's your comment?
Yeah, I'd like to ask your guest if he thinks that the gang problem that they have here in Missouri is as serious as it is in places like California, Chicago, and New York.
Thank you for your call, Keith.
All right.
Well, I'm not sure what the gang problem, how strong it is in other places. I can only, you know, go by what I see in media and what everybody else sees. And, of course, it's always pronounced a little bit more when you see it in media, so we have a different take on what that is. But there is a significant a gang issue here in the metro area. I wouldn't say that it's so significant to where you could equate it to other places like Chicago or California, though.
But it seems to me what we were talking about before, when you said goodbye to the gang and these you call them old heads want to take you in, it seems like it's not the problems aren't the gangs so much as the problems aren't there aren't enough choices of gangs to join, right? So you can go into Gangster's Disciple. You mentioned these other ones, but this gang, if we want to call it, of these old heads are willing to take you in. Perhaps there weren't enough of those around at the time, meaning those are the type of groups that, talking about hope, future, focusing on you as an individual, had there been more of those type of gangs around, whatever you want to call them, fraternities or book clubs or whatever, people call them gangs, but it seems like that might have potentially made a difference early on.
Well, I mean, I would suggest that there are those who are out there, but the thing about it is, me getting to where I was at in prison, I mean, that came from, you know, kind of a selfish situation. I mean, I wanted to make money like everybody else was doing, and in order to make that money, you had to ride with the people who were making that money.
Okay. You know, we've gotten to another show. We're still not through with you, Andre. If you're willing to come back, we're honored that you're here. Would you come back for a third show?
Yes.
And in the third show, ladies and gentlemen, what we'll do is we'll go into Andre's experience in the Kansas prison system and then moving on to where he is now. Again, the book that we're reading was Nathan McCall's Makes Me Want to Holler.
Correct.
Nathan McCall, McCall. And we appreciate you listening today. This is David Bell, and you're listening to Jaws of Justice.
It's the 420 Drug War News.
My name is Lauren Vasquez. I'm Deputy Director of Communications for the Marijuana Policy Project. I've been working in cannabis for about 10 years. We're working on a lot of different campaigns across the country. I'm helping with those and also with the California 2016 initiative. We have the National Conference of State Legislatures. It's an organization where the legislators get together and talk about policy and put forth resolutions declaring what they would like to see, and so they have voted to direct the federal government not to interfere with their state marijuana and hemp policies because they would like the opportunity to try something new, to end punitive policies and see what might work better in their states and their communities. There is a lot of hope, you know, a lot of common sense turnaround, where we've just seen the problems with our punitive marijuana policies building up to the point where, you know, cities and counties just can't afford to run the war on marijuana anymore, and they're not seeing any benefits. It's ineffective. They're not having communities that are any safer. And so right now they are open to new possibilities and new ways of of approaching marijuana and people who use it.
It's troubling the conscience of many in positions of power now, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know, nobody wants a law that causes more harm than the problem it's trying to solve. And, you know, many young people can use marijuana without long-term consequences, stay in school, get jobs. But if you get a criminal conviction, getting a job is not going to happen, and your education is going to be interrupted, and your opportunities for a future are going to be quashed. And, you know, it is hopeful to hear district attorneys saying these things, because we have far too many people that have minor criminal convictions that are really just destroying their opportunities.
All right, folks. Well, once again, we've been speaking with Lauren Vasquez. She's the Deputy Director of Communications for the Marijuana Policy Project. Lauren, any closing thoughts on the website you might want to relay?
It is www.marijuanapolicy.org, Marijuana Policy Project. I would like to say that it was a really great year for Texas. We did see a lot of movement forward, and, you know, we still have a lot more work to do, but there is a light at the end of the tunnel, and we are working with people, legislators, who do want to see change and do want to go toward more rational policies. So all the work you guys are doing there, thank you so much.
Question for you folks, how's your conscience holding up being a believer in drug war? Dean Becker, drugtruth.net.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and guest of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Mid-Coast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcast on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or want to help produce Jaws of Justice Radio, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live and find podcasts of our show on the KKFI website, that is kkfi.org. We thank our engineer Beth Pike for her work today. My name is Melvin Merritt, asking you to tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Tell Somebody with Tom Claymer on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Beautician Blues with Luscious Liam, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Ho. Stick around for jazz and blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Fiesta Musicale.